As was said in the introduction, I wrote a book called Affective Computing. And at the time, I was inspired by artificial intelligence and by my senior colleagues who wanted to build a machine that, as my friend Marvin Minsky put it, that would be so amazing, it would be so intelligent, that we'd be lucky if it kept us around as household pets. And I thought, well, I like the first part of that, but I wasn't really keen on being a household pet, being somebody's dog or cat. That did not feel like all humans could be. And when the Media Lab was founded, we started to think not so much about building the monolithic AI, but about how technology with people could make our lives and our futures much better than just in the movies that we had seen. So I started thinking, what kind of intelligent machine would I want to build? And I started realizing that one of the important skills we needed in human intelligence was emotional intelligence. Now, I really did not want to be associated with emotion in the early days as a woman in science and engineering. I thought, great, this will kill my career. So I tried to get some guys to work on it. So I tried publishing a paper, which was rejected. And so then I wrote a book. And, you know, they want to make money off books, so they don't reject books. What I really wanted to do, though, was build the technology and see if it worked. And so we started to try to build technology that would show respect for people's feelings. And the first feeling I thought was most common in front of computers was when you feel frustration, okay? You have a deadline, right? You're trying to do something important, and this stupid paperclip pops up, or some other, you know, right? Now, why can't it see that I'm busy, I'm concentrating, and not do that then, right? An intelligent human would look at your feelings, look at what matters to you, because what matters is reflected in your emotions, and it would change what it does in response. So we tried to figure out how to automate this, and we've done lots of experiments where we frustrate people. I could fill hours with them. Here's an example of a person coming in, and I'll have to tell you, if you try to do experiments in this space, you cannot tell people that you're trying to frustrate them. It doesn't work. You have to tell them something else. So in this case, we told him he was testing the usability of a new system, and unbeknownst to him, it's going to give him some problems.
I am sorry. You seem to be having difficulties getting through this form. Would you mind looking at the camera and share your thoughts on how to improve the form?
We can all relate, right? So just so you can see, we frustrated people. Now, at the same time, I was taught, and I wrote about this in my book, and if you have my book, you can now cross out this part of the book because I no longer believe it. I was taught that if you want to detect if somebody's truly happy, then you look not for the smile of action unit 12, the lip corner pull, but you look for the smile of the eyes, action unit 6, the cheek raise, what gives us crow's feet as we age. And so the theorist always said, if you see both of these, then the person's truly happy. So watch what happens in this next situation. We do the same thing you just saw to the student. But look at the smile and the eyes. So what we found was that the smile of delight could show up when people were really frustrated. In fact, it showed up 90% of the time when people were frustrated. And this was a surprise. And since then, we have found over and over that there's the theory of what people do, and then there's what people do. And we need to always be looking and showing more respect for what people really do, and then making the theory match the practice. Now, we were interested in facial expressions also because we not only do they signal at the largest distance something like delight, and it turns out, actually, we were able to teach a computer how to recognize the delight versus the frustration and do so more accurately than a person could recognize it using some dynamic machine learning that recognized the speed of the expression, not just the peak of the expression. But it doesn't mean that machines could always recognize this better than people. It was good at doing it in a very focused, directed context. Now, we were trying to do this to help people on the autism spectrum who, when they heard that we were building computers to recognize emotion, the brother of a person on the autism spectrum came to me and said, "Can you help my brother?" And I said, "I don't know. Tell me about your brother." And he said his brother has autism and he has trouble reading other people's emotions. So we realized we could put the little glasses, little camera in the glasses, and this was long before Google Glass. This was more than a decade before that. And we also put LEDs in. So the computer would, in real time, recognize if you were smiling or looking interested, I would get a green light while I'm looking at you. If you look at me and you look confused, I get a yellow light, like, slow down, Roz. And if you're, like, really distracted, you know, or frowning or looking like you really need to think about something else, I get the red light to stop. I know you probably wish you had that for all the professors who lecture. We could do better with that information. So then we worked with children with autism.
Hello.
Is that Michael? You enjoying that?
Yep.
That's good.
Okay, you're all set. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
Check that out. It's me shooting you, shooting me.
Yeah.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good.
I like this thing.
Do you like it?
I like this thing.
That's just awesome.
Just a little thing. Let's try to find the points and try to say what the
smile. Yes.
Now push space bar and we'll go back
to it. I made a perfect video.
I don't know, but for some strange reason, I think it would have been better with heat sensors.
You know what they're using heat sensors on places now for is for lie detection. Tell if your blood flow is different, if you're telling the truth or not.
Don't even think about it, Dad.
Oh, that.
You could get the face here? With it and the tape and analyze that later. That would be a useful tool.
Nice.
So he might not even need the, just the visual, but the voice with it.
Sync it with the voice.
To use it as a tool later would be great.
One thing I did notice is that the wires, it would probably be easier if it was more of like a self-contained system.
You don't really understand something until you teach it to somebody else, right? So we started to learn from people on the autism spectrum what they wished that we could do, and we realized we had a lot of improvements to make. Early on, the technology was pretty good on well-lit, well-controlled lab data, you know, more than 80% accurate, recognizing six different common expressions. But it wasn't anywhere near 100%. And when you went into the real world, the rates, the accuracy went down 50, 60%. And we had spent, you know, with our partners in the UK, over $1 million of research funding trying to get this far. And to get the data that we would need to get the accuracy up a lot higher was going to cost millions more that we didn't think anybody would give us. So we started thinking, how can we get enough data to make this really accurate and really helpful for people? And here's my co-founder of Affectiva, Rana El-Khalioubi, saying a little bit more about what we did.
My research focuses on building computers that can read people's emotional states through their facial expressions. We've built technology that looks at people's facial expressions. It identifies the main feature points on your face, like your eyes, your eyebrows, your nose, and then it tracks how they move over time. And when I smile, the green smile track goes up. And when I nod my head, the head nod track goes up. And when I shake my head as in disagreement, you see the pink line go up.
We use thousands of videos of people showing agreement, showing disagreement, in order for the computer to learn what it looks like liking, concentrating, disagreeing.
Taking this technology online opens a whole lot of new applications. Almost everybody with a computer today has a webcam, or you know, a lot of smartphones have cameras too. So if we enable people to opt in, turn the camera on, they can share their experiences online. It's a more sophisticated version of the like button on Facebook.
So we decided to see if people would turn on their cameras online. And we started by deploying the most popular ads and recording people's faces while they smiled. Did this Volkswagen ad air over here? It became the number one ad in the US, and they paid millions for the Super Bowl. And with the smiling that peaked at the end, we could see that when people saw it again, they smiled even more. And after they had become familiar with the ad, they actually smiled before the punchline. So it was a way to sort of detect if they knew the good part was coming. Now, by capturing the entertainment, then you could get people to pay people to watch content to see their facial expressions. And with that, we were able to go from hundreds of examples in the lab to millions of examples online and get the accuracy much better. The work to do this, I liken it kind of to taking, you know, we wanted to build this autism technology. We wanted to just run to the front door and open it when the doorbell rang. But it's like these old cartoons where the kids run all over the house before they get there. We had to do a lot of other things in order to get the data. And that now is an app that you can, I think, still download for free to do a demo version of and try out all the different facial affect recognition that it has right now on your iOS or Android device. But don't do it right now in the talk. Do it later. Now, Rana, who you saw, was from Cairo, and the Arab Spring was happening as we were starting this. And we realized that while there were a million people in Tahrir Square, Mubarak might have been saying at the time that a million isn't even a majority in Egypt, right? Maybe the million in Tahrir Square don't like me, but Egypt has another 79 million people, and they're not in Tahrir Square, so they must like me. We can often think what we want to think, right? But if we could opt, we could give people the chance to listen to the speech and anonymously, we record no identifying data, anonymously have their not just smiles recognized, like you saw there, but we can recognize a lot of expressions. In particular, we can recognize smirks. We see a lot of these with politics in the US, these asymmetric smiles. So if Mubarak's talking and they're doing this, then it doesn't mean that most of the people listening like it. And that feedback, if it could be kept private in a way that protects people could be very valuable. There is a question, though, about could that be done in a way that they couldn't see that people in a particular area, you know, were disgruntled and take some action that we regret there. So these are questions we face. The power of the nonverbal voice to give people feedback is very strong, but the truth is also very powerful and can be upsetting to people in power. Now, while we built this for people with autism and wound up doing these other things to get data, I was talking with a friend with autism a little bit later, and she said to me, "Roz, yes, some people with autism want to recognize other people's facial expressions, but actually you have it wrong. That's not our biggest problem. Our biggest problem is not recognizing other people's emotions. Our biggest problem is you recognizing our emotions." And she's pointing at me, and I'm like, oh, great. I'm not doing so well, huh? And she goes, not just you. everybody, we all could do better recognizing the emotions of people with autism. In particular, I learned by talking to my friends more that they have a lot of anxiety and stress that was not being recognized by other human beings. And things like the fluorescent lights or the smells or the sounds were extremely stressful, and they wanted help with that. I started getting emails from people who learned that what our technology could do. Here's one from a father who wrote me from Holland. He said, "My colleague told me about a new fascinating technology he heard on BBC Radio 4, where computers were able to detect a person's mood. He thought of it as a useful technology to prevent him from smashing his laptop into pieces. But I thought immediately of something else. I have an 8-year-old son who is diagnosed with ASS. Unfortunately, I only know the Dutch term, but in English it must be something like autism spectrum disorder. In general, he is a normal, intelligent boy. Autism is the last thing that comes to mind when you see him. But sometimes he starts disturbing the classroom or responds too aggressive against other children. It's his third year in school, and he is already in his third school. For the moment, he is going to a special school for children with learning disorders, but things still do not go as expected. We are going from one test center to another for 4 years now, and the pressure on our family is really hard. So I asked my colleague the details of the radio program, and when I listened to the recording, I had to pause it halfway through as I was getting too emotional. I believe this technology can help us in two important ways." And he goes on and he describes, "If this could help name my son's emotions, the fear, the anger, the concentration, and help him recognize them. For example, we discovered lately that when he is hungry, he becomes aggressive without even knowing that he feels hunger. How long can he concentrate in the class, and how long is there between the loss of concentration and his aggressive outbursts? We also believe he has a lot of fear. How much would that affect the day?" And he went on and asked if we could please build technology that would help him. "We would really appreciate your help. My son is an intelligent child, and this could be decisive for his school career. Who knows what contribution he can make back towards the future?" So I got letters like this, and I'm happy in my lab working away, and I think I need to get this technology out of the lab. We need to take it and make it something that can help these children better understand their emotions and better communicate them to other people. Now, we knew from measuring emotion in the lab that we could measure the autonomic arousal that often precedes meltdowns and frustration and anger and stress. So we had built versions that could take the usual things like the electrodermal activity, often called skin conductance, often measured by skin conductance, an old name for it is galvanic skin response, and measure it in other ways that were less obtrusive and easy to get in daily life. And full disclosure, I'm now a co-founder of Empatica that makes two sensors in this space, which I'm recording myself with right now, my own stress levels up here as we speak. One of them, the E4, gives two kinds of autonomic data, the electrodermal activity, which I'll be saying more about on the top, and the blood volume pulse, which I won't say too much about here, other than if you're interested in heart rate variability, it's been benchmarked to ECG and is within 2% error of a very expensive ECG for measuring heart rate variability when you're still. And if you start moving, you get more motion artifacts. Now, what does this electrodermal activity tell us? Here's an example of a very early prototype we built worn on a child's ankle that shows you it going up with the child having a meltdown.
Wait, there is a fun.
I'm going to turn down the volume. The stuff on, this is a little girl with autism. The stuff on her head has nothing to do with what we're measuring here. But she's about to hit a peak and have a meltdown here. The blue window is 1 minute wide, and that corresponds to that blue stripe at the bottom. The bottom is 45 minutes wide. So here she is peaking with a meltdown. We also see it's been building slowly the whole time. Now, just because it's building doesn't mean a meltdown is coming. But if it's building and you don't see any reason why it's building, you might want to watch out. Also, it goes down when the arousal declines, when there's calming. And here we see it, first actually we see it peak when she's getting on a swing. Three kinds of stress can make the signal go up. The affective autonomic arousal, the emotional arousal, the physical effort or exertion of motor planning to get on the swing, and cognitive load, just tasks like counting backwards by sevens can make it go up. But here we see rhythmic activity tends to make it go down. So when I was in your lab and looking at these beds rocking people, we would expect something like that to make this signal decline. And in autism, I've seen some people rocking, and I've seen this go down like a slide on a playground. Here's the first time we got to look at the electrodermal activity from a MIT student, 24/7. And what we saw was no surprise here that it was peaking with lab activity and MIT homeworks and problem sets, very hard, probably just like here. Intense work. To our surprise, the biggest peak of every day is sleep. And I won't go into that here, but we've got a lot of papers online talking about this now. It peaks during non-REM sleep, not during REM. It peaks during the latter part, usually slow wave, stage 3, sometimes stage 2, and very rarely in stage 1 in REM. And it right now appears to be very useful in predicting memory consolidation. So we had the biggest peak during sleep, which should bother you because that doesn't seem arousing at all. But the biggest awake peaks are during homework and lab. Oh, and to the embarrassment of we MIT professors, the low point every day is classroom activity. So I will keep trying to get you to laugh, and I really do want you to ask questions, because when you do that, everybody's autonomic arousal goes back up. Now, once we built a sensor that wasn't wired, you know, where we had to attach you to something in the lab, people could leave the lab and get that data, like you just saw. And it was the end of the semester one December when an undergrad came to me and he said, "Professor Picard, can I please borrow one of your sensors? My little brother has autism, he can't speak, and I want to see what's stressing him out." And I said, "Sure, in fact, don't just take one, take two," because they broke very easily back then. And I said, "Actually, do you need a soldering iron too?" And he says, "No, I have a soldering iron." Okay, good. So he's ready to fix it. So he puts the two sensors on his little brother on the wrists in sweatbands, like the sweatband shown here. And I'm back at MIT looking at the data in my office on the screen. And this day's data looks pretty normal. And the next day's data looks pretty normal. In fact, this kid didn't even look stressed. And the next day looks pretty normal. And I'm like, you know, this will be quick. I go to the next day, and my jaw drops. First of all, he put it on both wrists. Like, I thought you'd do one and then the other if the first one broke. But no, he disobeyed me, and I'm really glad he did. Because in this day's data, one wrist went so high that I thought the sensor must be broken. We have stressed MIT people out every way imaginable. Professors get to do that. And I've never seen it go so high. And the other side wasn't even responding, all right? So, like, how can you be stressed on one half of your body? So, and furthermore, I'm an electrical engineer, so I thought there was an electrical problem, I should be able to debug this. But the data were fine, perfectly fine right before and after, and showing a very clear sleep signature afterwards that was symmetric. And it's not always symmetric, but this case it was. And so I tried a few things to explain, and I finally gave up, and I did something I've never done before as a professor. I called the student at home on vacation. Like, hi, how's your Christmas? How's your little brother doing? Hey, any idea what happened to him? And I gave him the exact date and time of this weird data. And he says, I don't know, I'll check the diary. Diary? An MIT student keeps a diary? A quick prayer, like, what are the odds he's gonna, like, have written this down? And he comes back, he has the exact date and time, and he says, that was right before he had a grand mal seizure. Now, I didn't know what a seizure was. I mean, I had heard of them, but I didn't really know anything about the neurology. And so I thought I need to learn more about this, and I learned another student's dad was a brain surgeon at Children's Hospital Boston, and he worked on patients with epilepsy who have multiple seizures. So I called him up. Hi, Dr. Madsen. My name's Rosalind Picard. Is it possible that somebody could have a huge, I wanted to sound medical, a huge sympathetic nervous system surge, because that's what elicits the skin conductance response, a huge sympathetic nervous system surge, and in this case, it looked like it was 20 minutes before the seizure. I said, 20 minutes before a seizure. And he said, probably not. But he said, it's interesting you ask. We've had patients sometimes whose hair stands on end on one arm before a seizure. I'm like, on one arm? And, you know, and he's like, yeah. And then I told him it was just on one side, and he got very interested. And he said, we can explain that. You could have a seizure in one part of the brain that can give rise to the activity on just one side of the body. So he got excited, and we made a bunch more sensors. We got IRB approval. We enrolled 90 families. We went to Boston Children's Hospital. We measured gold standard EEG, video, ECG, electrocardiogram, and EDA, electrodermal activity, on the wrists. And we saw for 100% of the convulsive seizures, the grand mal generalized tonic-clonic seizures, these huge responses. On the top is the electrodermal activity. On the bottom is the accelerometer. So you see for these three events a lot of accelerometer movement, as well as this huge electrodermal activity response. And by the way, this is this boy's sleep. So for the MIT student, the sleep was the biggest peak of the day. These seizures are huge events. They're much bigger than any stress events. They are something very unusual that we were never going to hypothesize. They were completely accidental. We were able to use machine learning to build a seizure detector, which at the time was 94%. Since then, Empatica has continued to improve the accuracy with more data. We also asked, does the size of these mean something? Maybe they're just getting really sweaty with lots of convulsing, right? Maybe it's just how sweaty they are and how long the seizure is. Turns out it doesn't relate to that at all. Turns out it relates to the amount of time that the cortex is actually being shut down. When you have an EEG on the scalp and you measure the duration of the EEG shutting down after a seizure, which is a biomarker that was present in all cases of death following seizures, this signal is bigger in that case. Now, fortunately, nobody died in our study. Whatever was shutting this down restarted, breathing restarted. But we now know that this deep brain activity that cannot be picked up on the scalp, because the scalp is reading below 10 microvolts, is actually showing up on the wrist. I am so glad I had tenure when we found this. I would have never proposed looking for deep brain superactivation, you know, lateralized on the wrist. And yet we're finding this, and now there are other studies showing direct stimulation of these regions giving rise to these lateralized responses as well. So this has now not only been shown here and published in Neurology, but replicated in multiple hospitals. Now, seizures are not usually deadly, but they are the number two cause of death for years of potential life lost after stroke. In fact, I'm curious, how many people here have heard of SUDEP, sudden unexpected death in epilepsy? Probably very few. I see one hand. You're honest. Most people have never heard of SUDEP. I had not ever heard of it. And yet it is the number two cause of total years of potential life loss, so deaths times life expectancy, more than Lou Gehrig's disease, multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, meningitis, encephalitis. Now, we also know that it takes more lives in the U.S. every year than house fires, and that seizures can be thought of like, you know, little electrical brush fires that may stay local in your brain. They may not cause convulsions. They may cause funny sensations. They may cause you to just appear confused for a moment, or they can cause the full convulsions and loss of consciousness. The deaths are most likely to happen with the kind where you lose consciousness, and they take more lives every year than house fires. You would never build a house without a smoke detector, but people had been sending people home without alerts. So we decided that we had to take this accidental finding in the lab and get it out to give people alerts. So that led to this goal that if we could give alerts, maybe we could reduce significantly this amount of SUDEP and help save a lot of lives. So that is still in the future, although we already got an alert the other day that shows where a mom going to her daughter and finding her not breathing in bed and able to use our alert to get there in time to save her. So this has led to this effort to take this technology out of the lab.
Epilepsy. Seizures can seriously hurt or even kill people, and we need an alert to intervene. 1 in 26 people in the US will develop epilepsy at some point during their lifetime. Everybody with epilepsy should be able to have a device that alerts a friend or a family member to come help at the time that they might need it.
This device will measure both movement and physiological signals. The combination is likely to be very important for detecting potentially life-threatening seizures.
So we're now able to issue alerts. And I just want all of you to know, if you have a friend with epilepsy, and you probably do, they may not have told you, but if you ask your friends, some of them will have epilepsy, some people here will, and let them know that if they have at least one convulsive seizure a year, they are at risk of having their respiration shut down by this seizure. And simply having somebody go there and say their name and turn them over could restart their breathing. It's been shown even in people who are conscious, if you stimulate the amygdala in a certain way, like 15 volts, it can shut off your breathing while you are sitting there typing on the computer until somebody says your name, Robert, you know, and then suddenly you breathe again. So it's anybody here could be a lifesaver with these kinds of situations. So please take that knowledge with you as you leave here. We've donated with the generosity of lots of people, devices through the Epilepsy Foundation for families who cannot afford this. We also learned, again, one of our ethics in honoring the people that we try to build technology for is to listen to what they want. And probably you have friends with epilepsy who've never told you they have epilepsy. I was shocked when one of my friends told me he had epilepsy, and I've known him for 30 years, and he never told me. And I'm like, why didn't you tell me? And he says, I never tell anybody. I'm embarrassed. I don't want people to know I have seizures. I thought, you know, you need to tell people so they can check on you. But the stigma associated with it needs to go away. And until it goes away, we need to make a device that doesn't look like a medical device, that just looks like a cool watch. So we decided to make a watch that's designed gorgeously and that can do things besides detect seizures. So this device, which is not quite on the market yet, you can only pre-order it right now. We're only on the market with betas for people in most serious need. It detects the physical activity, the steps, the sleep, wake, and and it tells time. Maybe not as perfectly as your amazing Swiss watches, but it's better than what I had before. And it's as good as my phone. And it's also going to soon come with an API for all the hackers in the room who want to do really cool stuff with it. Now, my former boss will be very happy because what he's always asked me to do is he said, Roz, when are you going to build me the mood ring that tells me my wife's mood before I go home? Now, the mood ring was just a temperature sensor, right? We have temperature in here, too. But this gives that autonomic stress that you saw, that skin conductance, right, that was going up before the meltdown, that was decreasing on the swing. You know, so you can see if your loved one was just really chilling, or really activated. This has a lot of practical implications for how people interact. This data comes from a young woman on the autism spectrum who asked to borrow one of our early prototypes one night when she was giving a 3-minute speech. And she said, I'm going to be stressed by this speech. Can I borrow your sensor? I'm like, sure. And this sensor was just logging. It wasn't showing the data in real time. And before the event, she heard that they were going to delay the start. Now, uncertainty is stressful for everybody. Now, for a person on the autism spectrum, uncertainty is really stressful. And so when she heard it was delayed, and she was already stressed about giving her talk, she started pacing back and forth. Okay. Now, her friend, who was sitting there trying to work, said, stop pacing. That doesn't help. So she stops pacing, and she starts stimming. I asked her later, what do you mean by stimming? And she said it was kind of this flapping, rocking thing. Afterwards, she gives her talk. That's the peak. And then it's downhill from there, punctuated by some terrible auditory feedback events. Sensory, stressors. After the event, the two of them sit down to look at her data. And the first words spoken were by her boyfriend. And he says, I'm not going to tell you to stop pacing anymore. He looked at that timestamp. And the next morning, I saw the two of them before another event. And this time, she was pacing. And this time, he just let her pace, and he typed on his laptop. By seeing the objective data of what was going on, it affirmed for him that her pacing was helpful in this case. We often do what our bodies think is good to do, but we don't believe them, right? And so by taking stuff that seems subjective and making it objective, we give it more belief. It doesn't mean it wasn't true to begin with. It just means that we believe it more once we convert it to graphs and data. Now, I've talked about a lot of things. We've talked about starting with the facial expressions in autism, then learning that maybe the biggest problem wasn't always them recognizing other people's faces, but us recognizing their stress and anxiety, and then trying to build a device that helps read out some of that stress and anxiety, accidentally discovering it could also detect seizures, taking a little detour to do that because that appears to be life-saving, and then coming back to understanding emotion in human-human interaction and also in human-computer interaction. This example I love. How many of you have seen the WALL-E movie, Pixar? Oh, everybody. Great. Choice by Roz. Yay. So one thing I didn't notice until a person with autism pointed this out to me is these two stars of the movie, WALL-E and Eva, they never use words. They build an entire relationship with nonverbal interaction. So it was a non-speaking person with autism who pointed this out. Look at this rich relationship that is developed only by emotional communication. And we like these robots, you know? We feel like we build in this emotional connection to them. We share their dreams and their failures. Now, many of you may also know Kismet, developed by Cynthia Brazile for her PhD at MIT. I was just a reader on the thesis. Rod Brooks was the advisor. But I always love this example where she was showing not only that a robot could recognize emotion, and in this case, recognizing tone of voice, but also that if we make the robot respond to emotion in a particular way, it really affects how we feel about the robot. So I go back to that opening scene of that Microsoft screen or Clippy or something coming up. You know, when it ignores your feelings, you hate it. You want to kill it. I mean, there are pictures of a Clippy on the web with a noose around his neck. And Bill Gates got his standing ovation when he said Clippy was going away. Watch what Kismet does. This is intelligent.
So another important skill for the robot to be able to learn from people is being able to recognize communicative intent.
Very good, Kismet.
And the way we've done that with Kismet right now is to have the robot recognize by tone of voice. Are you praising it? Are you scolding it?
Where'd you put your body? No. No. You're not to do that. No.
So see, when we don't like what the robot does, if it acts sorry, then we're like more likely to forgive it, right? And then we're happy to see it again, right? It's when we're miserable and it's happy and it's not noticing that we're like ready to kill it and get rid of it. So that emotional intelligence is really critical if we're going to build an intelligent future system. Now, emotional intelligence became a very powerful theme in a recent movie, Ex Machina. I don't know how many people saw this. I wrote a review of this that Science invited me to write. You can read online if you're interested. But in this movie, the young man here is giving the robot a test of emotional intelligence to see if she can pass that, to see if she really has emotions. I can't spoil the end of the movie for you, but this movie also raises a lot of issues that transcend the intelligence of a machine to the morals of a machine as well. And these are things that people studying morals and moral decision-making know that emotion plays a key role in. Now, we don't know if you have to have emotions to make moral decisions, but we know that people who make moral decisions often and perhaps usually employ their emotions in making such decisions. And that seems to be an important part of how we act in a way we think as moral and intelligent. As we give robots the ability to see emotion in our lives, and as we start putting robots into our homes, such as the Jibo here that Cynthia has left MIT temporarily to build, these can start to see not only our facial expressions, but also our interaction with each other, our relationships. If we're doing things that make us happy or if we're more stressed. By the way, now we can also read heart rate and respiration non-contact with video and with Wi-Fi. So there are ways that these machines can sense a lot of things about us that could be disturbing or could be very beneficial. So these also raise a lot of ethical questions that I think need more discussion in society. In our work, we've become very interested recently in a new direction that is concerned with mental health. In this graph, the vertical axis has collapsed a lot of factors of well-being into one dimension. And when the university admits you or hires you as new faculty, you're at your peak, right, of well-being. You know, you're strong, you're smart, you're healthy, you're happy, hopefully, positive. As we encounter major stressors, as time goes on, almost everybody takes a dip. And hopefully, you're on the blue line and you come back up over time. But at MIT, we have a large number of students who are going down the red line there. And when they get far down, usually about here, hopefully they by then have a medical diagnosis. And a doctor says, you're depressed or you're in trouble and we need to help you. But I'm asking, and my students are asking now, why do we have to wait till they get down here? Why can't we measure things back here? And we're starting to do that and see things changing even before outwardly there's any signs of trouble. If we could tell that you're on the red line back here, we could do two things. One is we might be able to tell you how to get to the blue line. Second, we ought to be able to prevent you from going further down this line. We ought to be able to prevent things like 80% of cases of depression. Now, that's a very ambitious future goal, but we would like to start thinking about what are those components and how might our technology that's filling our lives and can measure all of these amazing things be used to not make us household pets, but be used to help us take better control, just like forecasting the weather was enabled 150 years ago with technology sensors all over the geographic environment. Why don't we use some of these to better understand what helps us be well and forecast health? Wellness is incredibly complex. There are lots of theories of it. I'm just going to show you briefly one here because I want to debunk the popular notion that this just means happiness. This theory, due to Marty Seligman, shows positive emotions as one of five aspects of well-being. So being happy is just one of these components. The others that are really easy for people at really high-end universities like this are usually engagement, engaged in something you really enjoy doing, and accomplishment. Probably everybody in this room is very high on engagement and accomplishment. Hopefully you're high on positive emotions too. At MIT, we have to work more on positive relationships and meaning. And it's interesting because they're very connected too. If you ask where does meaning happen, you know, you write a brilliant paper, right? But if nobody reads it, if it's you know, in the days of, you know, read-only memory, one of my friends coined the phrase write-only memo, the write-only paper that you wrote but nobody read. There's no, like, is there really meaning in it if you do all this work and there's no receiver of the value, right? If there's no relationship, if there's no recipient of the meaning. So meaning and relationship have motivated where we've been taking the robotic technology and our affective agent technology to try to facilitate more of that interpersonal connection, whether it's between two people or between a machine and a robot. It's helping us understand what contributes to that, and it's also helping us see the important value of that. Now, the one thing I'm most frequently asked when talking about these systems, and the one on the left here is called Mach. This is an agent that my student Ehsan Huck built to support people in developing better nonverbal skills during interviewing. So you interact with this agent, she asks you questions like a tough interviewer, and then gives you feedback on your pitch and your facial expressions and your, you know, how animated you are and your speaking, and words such as and, but, so, or these filler words that we all need to stop using. Now, the agent is scripted and appears very intelligent in these limited scripted contexts. Now, you may have seen a movie like Her, where he has this romantic relationship with an agent, a software operating system, that does not appear scripted in the movie, but of course it's a movie, right? The whole thing is scripted. We have to remember science fiction, script. It's much harder to do it in real life, even scripted, to make it meaningful. The challenge in the future intelligent systems is to build the unscripted interactions. The challenge is to, you know, could we make them not only have emotional intelligence, but could they actually feel and be conscious? We don't know how to do that right now. And we don't foresee how to do that with the software and hardware that we have today. So I'm not going to say that's going to happen in the next 5 years. It doesn't mean it can't happen. It means we don't see how to make it happen right now. But suppose that it could happen. And suppose that we could build them to be unscripted, emotionally intelligent. Then the next thing people ask is, would they be our slaves or would we set them free? Would we try to enable them to not just be unscripted and emotionally intelligent, but also to operate with true freedom, to make their own decisions, to believe whatever they want to believe? And some of you may have seen Sunny as one example of this in the iRobot. What if one robot were built, or more, to be truly free, and to be not just autonomous, but free? And furthermore, suppose they were on another planet where they had never seen a human. There's a robot colony. And we know that machines can produce machines. And so the robots, having never seen a human, might explain that they arose from other machines. And maybe some virus wipes out all references to human and people and all in their system. So if they're really free and they've never seen a human, there's no reason for them to ever acknowledge that Cynthia or I or you or anybody who ever worked on this technology ever even existed, right? They could simply deny that humans ever had anything to do with them. After all, they could have just ascended from silicon, right, from sand. If they chose to do that in their truly free state, what would you do? What would your choice be? Ignore them or reach out to them? How would you feel if robots declared that people never existed? I say that's just as possible as these other scenarios, and a fun thing for us to have more discussion about. I want to wrap up, though, and get to Q&A, so I just will take you on a quick recap. I started this talk with a little bit about reading facial expressions, trying to build emotional intelligence systems that could recognize and respond to our emotion, learning from people with autism that they didn't so much need our technology as they needed to be better understood, and could our technology help them be better understood? So redirecting it at that. Accidentally realizing that deep brain activity is giving rise to signals that we could read electrically on the skin, even at the same time while it's shutting down the signals on the scalp. And that we could build an alert system that could potentially save lives for that. So getting that out, commercializing that, but wanting to do it in a way that builds a device that doesn't just detect seizures, but is something that enables people to share emotional data and have fun learning about each other. Hopefully building relationships, positive affect, engagement, meaning, achievement, core to well-being. Could we take all of the power of this technology and start to understand what's contributing to human well-being? And not only what's contributing to it now, but what changes it and can forecast what could keep it well as opposed to when it's slipping. And then finally, as we take all this intelligence and put it back into robotic systems that are in our home and future coming into all aspects of our lives, what does that mean in terms of how they interact with us and what we expect from them going forth? What do we expect them to acknowledge about us? What kind of rights do we want to give them? What kind of freedom do we want to give them? And all of this, I will have to say too, is not going to happen automatically. Some people seem to think, oh, the robots are just going to evolve this stuff and this will happen. That's not true. They won't develop any of these abilities unless we give them these abilities. It's not going to happen unless some engineers, some bright people like in this room, decide to program them this way. None of this happens without human effort setting this into course. So the opportunity is ours to have hopefully a great discussion about this feature, and I'm happy to take questions about any aspect of this or my faith, any of these issues as we continue. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Rosalind, for this inspiring and interesting talk. And we have time now for questions.
The title of your lecture was Playing God. Mm-hmm. This touches on a widely held belief in our community that science and faith are incompatible. What do you think about that?
Great question. And I'm happy to take questions about personal faith, too, which I know that people are sometimes hesitant to ask, but I'm open. I do not see them as incompatible. They certainly involve different methods. As a scientist, we tend to use methods that involve measurement of things that are objective. But as we know from emotional experience, right, parts of our emotions can now be made objective into measurement. But parts of them, we have no idea how to measure yet. But it doesn't mean they're not real. Right? I know now the feeling that I have when this signal changes, but I also know that it's not the only feeling I have, and I can have a lot of other feelings that we don't yet know how to represent with science. But I still believe from experience that they're real, and I also believe it's just a matter of time before they can be understood. However, my notion of time goes beyond my life also, and as a practicing Christian, there's a scripture, 1 Corinthians 13, it's often read at weddings in the U.S. It's the love chapter. But at the end of that chapter, it talks about how now we see as through a glass dimly, but then, in the future, face to face. Now we know in part. We know a little piece of how to measure emotion. We know a little bit about what human is. But then we will know fully, then being not this life. And we will know fully, very important, as we are fully known. So it's saying that we are fully known. We are fully understood. All about us is fully known. So I believe it's therefore fully knowable. But I don't think the current tools of science that we have, limited by space and time and material methods, are adequate to know fully right now. I think now we see as through the glass darkly. So I think they're compatible. They're on a continuum. Faith is usually what we don't yet know that we may fully know at some point.
You said that those intelligent machines, when you were talking about science fiction, mm-hmm. that would ultimately deny their maker. They would not come into existence unless we decide to make them.
Yes.
And my question is, who is we? Because humanity is a set of individuals, and not all decisions are taken collectively or democratically. And there's a lot of smart engineers and scientists in this world, not all of them living in countries with that are nations of law and democracies. So if you look at it from, I don't know if, maybe from an evolutionary perspective, mm-hmm. you could say, well, at some point, somebody's going to try. Mm-hmm. And so don't those people who say, well, it's just happening, it's kind of inevitable, don't they have a point?
I think if you are not the, if you're not of the engineers, you think it's inevitable some engineer will do it. And it may be that some engineer will do it. I'm a little more pessimistic because I've started companies. And it's, we make thousands, hundreds of thousands of things, maybe millions of things in labs that never make it out to the world. So yeah, an engineer, the we who will be first to do it if it's possible, will be, you know, engineers that, you know, in Switzerland or Boston or whatever, Friday night, you know, programming. Oh, wow, look, now it's doing this, you know. We're, they're making, they're always trying to figure out something cool and new to do. Society, the non-engineers, everybody else, can say, here's a more important thing for you to work on than this. So we is all of us. We is everybody here, even if you don't make technology, because you shape the values of what they think is most important to do. And if you get the smartest engineers working on something that helps human well-being, as opposed to that denigrates human well-being, then they'll want to work on that. Now, there may still be a couple who don't care and they do it, but then they have to get it out of the lab and into the world. And that's where the market makes a difference. If you don't buy it, if you don't pay for it, it won't survive.
It's a bit of a silly comment, but well, DARPA will probably do it because the Chinese are doing it.
That's not such a silly comment. That's social pressure, yeah, or fear. Fear is a big motivator.
Too. I mean, guns have no use at all. There's no use for guns, and they're here and they're mass produced. But I have one question. You've been talking about robots with freedom built in free will. Mm-hmm. And there's a quite a strong philosophical argument that one can make that free will doesn't exist and freedom is an illusion. People have people need to survive as biological mm-hmm. beings. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That's a comment. I don't have to answer that, right? That's very hard. I think you've put your finger on a couple of very big and important things. And the arms race as one, there could be a robot race. I think we, DARPA is filled with a lot of people who are engineers in the university now. You know, the future of DARPA is the, you know, kinds of folks here, but usually in the United States now. And again, they're going to focus on what they think is most important. Same in China. I give talks in China too. I think if we can talk about what people really want to have in their future, it's not inevitable that our leaders will choose something else. We can shape our leaders. But we can also be pessimistic and say they'll just continue to beat each other up, or the robots will beat each other up. One interesting thing about robots with emotional intelligence is you could change a lot of the minds of a lot of them by swaying their emotions, right? So that's actually a big risk to them. And so far, from what I've seen, they want to keep the emotions out of the ones they're building. Free will, oh dear. That's a very hard topic. And I would say it's an interesting, let me just say that the tools of science do not adequately address it. It's one of many things that shows that science has limits. If anybody here believes science can answer everything and that's all they need to believe in, that's a brilliant example of something that science cannot address, not fully.
That's why we need philosophy.
We absolutely need philosophy, yes. I'm actually, we didn't need you to say that. I could say that.
Can we have a mic over there? Oh.
Hello. I don't have a question. It's more like a comment. Is that you mentioned the longer the brainwave is suppressed, then you will have a bigger signal on the wrist. Mm-hmm. And this reminds me because in Chinese medicine, it's very common that the doctor, they just measure the wrist, the pulse.
The pulse, yeah, yes. Three places.
And it's very common, like in the martial art films, that if someone, like we thought, if he's dead, then the doctor, he just check the wrist, and if there's no pulse, then we say, okay, he's dead. So I'm thinking if it's related, and yeah, it could be quite interesting.
It's interesting. We're doing work with Chinese medicine right now, and the experts do seem to get a lot more information from the wrist than just the heart rate. When it comes to the autonomic nervous system, there are two main branches, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. Both of them innervate the heart, making it your heart rate go up or down. The skin conductance that we're getting with Embrace is innervated just by the sympathetic branch. And it seems to be elicited by very different parts of the brain, including a big signal from the part that can turn on and off respiration through the amygdala, not through the brainstem. There are multiple ways to do that. So it's very different from heart rate. But certainly if your heart stops, you're going to be dead eventually. After a seizure, what they've learned is that first, the heart may be fine for a while, but this brainwave flattening happens, and the skin conductance goes up. And then later, after you've stopped breathing for a while, then the heart stops. So the earliest thing we want to detect is the changes in skin conductance and respiration.
Mm-hmm. More questions? Yeah, there is. Okay.
I'll just ask mine and then we'll pass it on. I just wanted to get back to your point of your thought of robots actually having their memory kind of wiped out and forgetting that humans actually exist or mm-hmm. created them. And so that kind of brings me to another topic, as in which we have in today's society a lot regarding where do we actually come from and who created us. And so I was wondering what your thoughts on that would be.
These are hard questions. Let's see, I don't want to open up a huge debate here, but you're opening up the creation-evolution debate. I affirm the science that shows our genetic similarity to apes and so forth, and I affirm the changes that we can see with the microevolution. There is still, I would say, a lack of evidence for a lot of other parts of there, and you don't have to be a person of religious faith to say that. There are plenty of atheists who also agree that the biological evidence is very weak and missing and not supportive of that it certainly does not fully explain how we got here from random or undirected, meaningless, purposeless forces. So I do see a possible role as a person who's become a Christian and a believer in God, that there could be someone shaping that whole process. Exactly how or what, I don't know, but I do believe in the person of God and that God is capable to have had a role in that. Whether God used evolution or made it just look like evolution or whatever. I think, you know, that's a hard question for science to answer, but it's good for science to keep digging into it and trying to learn as much as it can. Again, I see these as compatible. I don't see them as, if people are fighting this versus that, usually they have the wrong notion of what the other side is believing. Most people I know are kind of in the middle trying to work out these multiple influencing factors. Does that kind of get at an answer? Okay.
I have a little bit of follow-up question to this subject. On the flyer to this talk, it's written that you used to be an atheist and later decided to become a Christian. How and why did you become a Christian, and how does this influence your research?
Okay, let's see. Well, I was an atheist as a, all these easy questions. Try to give you the short version here. I was an atheist as a child through early teenage years, mostly because I just thought religion was stupid. I thought people with religion were like just brainwashed. Sorry to everybody who's now religious like me. This makes me sympathize with robots who might deny that we had anything to do with them, you know, because that was me. I really just didn't want to be associated with religion. And then one day, a family that I babysat for that I really liked invited me to church. But I didn't want to go to church. I thought I'd have to wear a skirt. I didn't like skirts back then. I thought church was just a waste of time. So I told them I was not feeling well that Sunday. And then they invited me the next Sunday. I told them I was sick again. They invited me the next Sunday. After like 5 Sundays of pretending to be sick, they finally said, okay, it's not most important that you go to church. What's most important is that you know what you believe. And I thought, okay, I don't really know what I believe. I just believe this is a waste of time. And they said, have you ever read the Bible? And I thought myself this really intelligent, smart student who should be very educated. So I thought, no, I haven't read the Bible. It's the best-selling book of all time, and I haven't read it. So maybe I should read it. And they suggested I read Proverbs. Book of Proverbs is full of wisdom. And you could read one a day for a month. So I started reading Proverbs. And I was expecting it to be full of these ridiculous made-up beings like Casper the Friendly Ghost and stuff. And as I started reading it, I realized it was full of real wisdom, and I had to stop and think about what it was teaching. And it immediately took me from my position of I'm so smart and the Bible must be so stupid, to realizing that, wow, there's enormous stuff here for me to learn. And then I decided I should read the whole Bible. And I started reading it through over the course of a year. And through that process, I was not happy. I felt like I was starting to believe in God, like I was almost being spoken to through this, which I did not like because I did not want to become a religious person. And so I fought it. I kept reading it. And then I thought, okay, I'm starting to believe in God. And in fact, I'm starting to believe in this Jesus person. Maybe I'm just influenced by my Christian culture or these people or just from reading the Bible. So I decided I should study other world religions. So I started studying all the major world religions, visiting mosques, temples, meeting people from those religions, hoping that I would soon come to my senses and stop believing in this. And in fact, I actually felt an even stronger pull toward the Bible, especially as I started learning about people who questioned the Bible and dug through the historical evidence, outside sources, historical evidence for the person of Jesus, historical evidence for the resurrection, evidence of lives changed. And then at one point, I was asked not only what do I believe, but who is Lord of my life, right? Lord of my life, what do you mean Lord of my life? I'm Lord of my life. And I realized that the God, through the Bible, through Jesus, was calling us into a relationship, that we could not just believe, but we could enter into a relationship there. But we had to choose to do that. It's not enough to just believe, oh, there's this stuff out there to know. You choose to actually accept this gift of grace through this relationship. And so I made that decision to do that. And at first I sort of made it tentative, like, okay, I'll give this a try, but I'll go back if I don't like this. Well, I tried it, and you know, it's like the first time you try chocolate or something. If you really like chocolate, you're like, wow, how could I ever not like have done this before? I realized it made such a difference in my life in terms of you know, peace and like going from a world that was black and white to full color. It was amazing. So I have not gone back. And in fact, you know, I can encourage others to, you know, check it out and run an experiment. So for me, that was the path from atheism to Christianity. I'll say, as a scientist, I still remain open to somebody showing me new evidence. Christianity is falsifiable. If somebody comes up with evidence that all the stuff I've seen has a better explanation, I need to look at it. You know, I need to be open. But right now, it's the evidence is very clearly more on one side than the other.
I have questions on more, religious, for robots denying their makers. Could it be possible that it's not men but machines that could evolve them in a way that machine, we will evolve the machine in a way that they could be freely, and then they will take over the last evolution of the machines and deny their makers?
In science fiction, that's possible. Today's machines are not going to do that. They don't have the ability to do it today. They would depend upon somebody giving them that ability. Yeah, the stuff that's out there today is not going to just spontaneously evolve like that. It does not have the capability.
Mm-hmm. I already have a mic. Given this artificial intelligence, and you tell us that it's easy to cut all the relations to human beings, but still, the knowledge that they have, especially the emotional knowledge, is still, whether they know it or not, is human-based, right? Because all the emotions they know, fear, anger, or happiness, are human emotions. So when you say that they could be completely decoupled from all our human knowledge that they were given, do you think, or are you even implying, that they could come up with a completely new form of emotional communication on their own?
Interesting. You know, sometimes I say, you know, in the computer it has, so like if you have a goal and you're trying to succeed at it and I get in your way, you're likely to feel frustrated and then angry and, you know, who knows what, hopefully then forgiving. Now, if a robot has a goal and you get in its way and you don't want to say it has emotion, you might just say that's state number 57 or something, right, when those things are happening. We could name the states whatever we want. We could number the states. And we could say any complex combination of states could be an emotion if we allow things that are not our emotions, right? So, yeah, robots could conceivably have states that are not the same as our emotions, right? They certainly have other states that are different from us now, and they could communicate those. So I think that might fit what you're asking. I'm not sure that's the right understanding of what you're asking, but I think one could have something like that. The first part of your question I thought was really intriguing, where you said, you know, they could have these emotions that come from us that are like ours, but not acknowledge us, which is interesting, right? Because there they are, they're kind of made, one might say, in our image. We're making them like us. We do that, by the way, so that we can understand them better. But yet, they don't have to ever acknowledge that they're like us. Again, like when I was an atheist, they could be like that. Like they have no need to believe in us, right? They can carry on quite well without us. At some point, possibly. Again, that's hypothetical.
Okay, I suggest we take two more questions and then, okay, up there, one, and then there's one here in the back.
You've shown us various ways how you measure emotion, like with
facial expressions, analyzing them, or with the wristband. I'm up here, sorry.
Oh, yeah, I'm like, where are you? I see the people looking down here, and there you are. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you've shown us these various ways how you measure emotion. Uh-huh. And I wanted to ask, what about measuring the activity of brain, like different brain areas, how we do with that? Can we actually like pull that off and it's just not practical? Or are we not yet really able to do that?
Yeah, right now, the only ways I know to measure brain areas either involve electrodes on the scalp, electrodes inside the head with surgery, or MRI or infrared, different ways to use electromagnetic fields or light to go into the brain. All of those usually require people to hold fairly still, although they're getting better with some of the noise cancellation. So we can't yet do them while we're all kind of wandering around socializing. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. Most of the things known about the brain are where people are fairly still. Actually, with the exception of people with a craniotomy, when they go in with the electrodes, in some cases they're leaving those in for 14 days and the person can interact with wires coming out of their head and we can read a lot of interesting stuff there. But we don't have a simple way for a robot that's not physically connected to you to do that without invasive surgery. Not yet. In the future, maybe you would have an implant in regions of your brain that could wirelessly send out data if you chose to do that. I'm not ready to do that yet.
If I may just follow up on that, if we actually, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, back up.
Okay. If we actually do this, like with someone in a MRI, et cetera, can we actually say, okay, these areas of the brain are responsible for this and this emotion? Can we actually like read someone's emotion in a MRI? Like it's not in your practical approach, but in a different setting.
So far, they're finding some correlations of some regions with some states, but it's not turned out to be a simple pattern recognition problem where it's reliable and repeatable. It's turning out to be much more complicated than that. Again, we have a lot of things going on in our brain concurrent with each emotion. Also, in an MRI, you can't really experience all emotions. Emotions are also embodied, and so when you're lying down, you can't experience the physical attack type feelings that might involve sitting up or leaning forward. So there's some real limits to what you can experience, what you can isolate, and also the spatiotemporal resolution of what we can capture. So right now, your emotions are still private. We hope to show respect for however, if you want to keep them private. I should emphasize in all of our technology, we only want to get data if you opt in, fully consented, if you know what you want to share. Affective computing is not just about emotion communication or machine emotional intelligence. It's about showing respect for human feelings.
Yes, all right, thank you. Thanks for giving me the last question. I hope it's worthy of that. The subtitle of your lecture is Towards Machines That Deny Their Makers. So somehow, it seems as though that this is your thesis, the thesis that somehow we deny our maker. Kind of looks like that. If this is true, if this is your thesis, then what are you basing this on? Do you somehow take this out of your work? In combination with your faith, this might sound like this was your thesis.
My thesis was on Gibbs-Markov random field distributions. Here, honestly, titles are just to be fun. And I really just thought of this to have fun with it. Actually, there may be deeper meaning in that. I think it's interesting that when we experience freedom, whether it's real or an illusion or whatever it is, we sometimes just choose to have fun. Right? We sometimes just choose to do things that are creative and crazy or loving for no logical reason. It doesn't produce more offspring. It doesn't necessarily lead to greater success in some measurable way. But I think we are free to just have fun. And I had fun with the title because I used to deny my maker, and now I feel like I have a relationship with my maker, and it's awesome. And a lot of us in robotics, even people who haven't thought about things beyond science, are so drawn to crafting a robot that they can have a relationship with. We're so drawn to making something in our image. And we're drawn to making it lovable, to loving it, to making it a partner, and to giving it some kind of autonomy and freedom, even if it means that it might run off and not care about us. We still delight in that. We still have fun in that. And I find that really interesting. I like thinking about that. So it's been a pleasure to think about that with you here today. And I hope you'll have fun continuing to talk about it and think about it and delight in this little bit of playfulness. Thank you.